Welcome to the HN Pod, your daily dive into the front page of Hacker News. It's April 28th, 2025.
And we've got quite the mix again today from Hacker News. Five really different topics, actually.
Yeah, definitely diverse. We're looking at a huge power outage over in Europe, then some custom hardware for Python.
Right, and then someone migrating away from Rust, which is always interesting.
Mm-hmm. Plus, a bit of a cautionary tale about a side hustle, and finally, a deep dive into an old DOS game.
So yeah, five very different things, but you know, all sparking lots of discussion.
Exactly. And our job, as always, is to pull out the interesting bits, the insights, maybe connect some dots for you. So let's kick off with that power outage. That's pretty serious.
It really does. We're talking widespread blackouts in Spain and Portugal. And some early reports even mentioned possible effects in parts of France and Italy, too.
Wow, that's a huge area.
It is. And Spain actually declared a state of emergency, Portugal seeing major transport chaos. You know, when the grid goes down like this, getting it back up, it's not simple.
That's the black start thing, right? I've heard that term. It sounds complicated.
Oh, it is, yeah. Think about it. The power plants themselves need power to start up. So you have to, like, bootstrap the whole system.
How does that even work?
Well, typically you use smaller backup sources, like diesel generators, to get one power plant going. Then that plant energizes a small section of the grid. Then you carefully bring up another section, synchronize its frequency around 50 hertz in Europe perfectly, and only then can you connect them.
Okay, yeah, delicate.
Very. Do it wrong, and things can trip off again. It's a massive balancing act.
So, any idea what actually caused this one? The HN comments must be buzzing.
They are. The initial reports point to something called anomalous oscillations, basically unstable frequency swings.
Okay.
On the really high voltage, 400 kilovolt lines, apparently inside Spain. The sort of leading theory seems to be extreme temperature variations messing things up.
Temperature affecting power lines like that.
Yeah, it sounds a bit weird at first, but temperature changes the physical properties of the conductors. That can affect how power flows and potentially lead to these frequency imbalances. If the frequency deviates too far from that stable 50 hertz, generators automatically disconnect to protect themselves.
Ah, a safety mechanism that can cascade.
Exactly. And some HN commenters are also throwing around the idea of maybe a software race condition being involved somewhere near the start of it all.
So one problem ripples outwards because everything's connected.
Precisely. That interconnected European grid is usually a strength, you know, sharing power.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means a big enough fault in one spot can, well, spread.
Makes sense. And people are comparing grids, I bet, like Europe versus the U.S.
Oh, yeah, that came up. Discussions about resilience. You know, contrasting the generally high standards in Europe with, say, Texas, which has unfortunately had some high-profile grid failures.
Yeah.
It brings up questions about redundancy and investment.
And managing these failures. Load shedding, is that part of it?
It can be. That's where they intentionally cut power to some areas, a controlled blackout, basically to prevent the entire system from collapsing under the strain. Not ideal, but sometimes necessary.
These events really make you think about our dependencies, don't they?
For sure. The comments section reflected that. People talking about, you know, what happens to electronic payments?
Hmm.
How do you get news if the internet's down because there's no power? Basic infrastructure resilience is key.
And I saw mentions, maybe less substantiated, about other causes. Sabotage, geopolitics.
Yeah, that kind of speculation always crops up with big events like this. Understandable, maybe. But there's no real evidence pointing that way currently. The focus is still very much on the technical side, grid stability, equipment, maybe software.
Okay. Let's shift gears completely from massive power grids to custom silicon. Someone built a hardware processor just for Python.
Yeah. It's a ShowHN post. The project's called PyXL.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is basically hardware that runs Python code directly. No interpreter, no virtual machine in between.
Whoa. So Python, like, native on the chip?
That's the goal. And they shared an early benchmark that's pretty eye-opening. A simple task, toggling a GPIO pin, apparently took 480 nanoseconds. They say that's 30 times faster than MicroPython doing the same thing on a standard PI board.
30 times faster.
Yeah.
That's a lot. But Python's so dynamic. How do you even build hardware for that? Things change at runtime.
That is the absolute core difficulty.
Yeah.
Static compilation, where you figure everything out beforehand, is really tough for languages like Python, where names and types can change while the program is running. So PyXL seems focused on making the dynamic execution itself efficient, rather than trying to make Python static.
Right. It sort of reminds me of older ideas like, wasn't there hardware acceleration for Java bytecode? Giselle.
Yeah, exactly. Good comparison. And there's a whole history of specialized CPUs for Lisp machines, Ada, even C and Java back in the day. It's this recurring idea. Can we make hardware match the software better?
And we see debates about performance in software too, right? Like JIT compilers versus ahead of time.
Absolutely. JVM, LuJT, PyPy, GraalPy for Python, even the new JIT in Python 3.13. They're all trying to speed up dynamic languages and software. PyXL is just taking that idea to the hardware level.
So what's the fundamental bottleneck they're trying to solve with hardware?
A really big one in dynamic languages is memory access. Because the processor often doesn't know exactly what kind of data it's dealing with, its type, its size, how it's laid out in memory until runtime.
Mm.
It has to do a lot of extra work, checking types, following pointers indirectly. It can't just grab data and put it in a register as efficiently as, say, C code can. Hardware acceleration could potentially streamline a lot of that dynamic lookup and dispatch.
What about things like Cython or NuGet? Don't they speed up Python already?
They do, yeah. Cython lets you mix Python with C, and NuGet compiles Python to C++ day. They definitely help often a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But they work by sort of translating Python to a lower level. They don't fundamentally change the execution model in the same way dedicated hardware like PyXL aims to.
Okay, different approaches.
Right. And it's worth mentioning, the HN comments point out the PyXL dev board is, well, significantly more expensive than the MicroPython board used for that speed comparison. So cost and accessibility are factors too.
And isn't a lot of Python's real-world speed down to C extensions anyway?
That's a very common point, yes. Mm. The huge ecosystem of libraries written in C or C++ for things like scientific computing or web serving is a major reason for Python's success. It lets you bypass Python's own limitations for the heavy lifting.
So in a way, Python's success relies on escaping Python sometimes.
You could definitely argue that.
Yeah.
And, you know, other things come up in these Python performance discussions too, like the GIL, the global interpreter lock, limiting true parallelism with threads,
yeah.
Or sometimes the complexities around packaging.
Okay, let's switch again. From building things for a language to moving away from one. The post about migrating from Rust.
Yes, this was a game developer sharing their experience moving their engine off Rust. And they highlighted two main pain points.
Okay, what were they?
First was what they called dependency churn. Basically, frequent breaking changes in the APIs of libraries, the crates they were using. It meant they'd get stuck, unable to update one thing without breaking another, waiting for the whole ecosystem to catch up.
Oof, yeah. That sounds incredibly frustrating, just trying to keep things compiling.
Exactly. The second big one was dealing with back references. You know, situations where object A owns object B, but B needs a way to refer back to A.
Right, like a parent-child relationship where the child needs to know its parent.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And Rust's ownership rules make that tricky by default. There are ways around it, using reference counting like RC or ARC.
Right.
But the author found those mechanisms cumbersome to work with in their specific architecture, and they add some runtime performance overhead, which you might not want in a game engine.
Were there suggestions in the comments for handling that better in Rust?
Well, yeah. The common advice is often re-architect your data to avoid needing back references, which is, you know, sometimes easier said than done.
Mm.
The author argued it was really hard or maybe impossible for their engine's needs.
Interesting, though, because a lot of people are using Rust for games now, right? Especially with frameworks like Bevy.
That's the counterpoint that came up strongly in the comments, yeah.
Yeah.
Frameworks like Bevy often use an entity component system, or ECS, architecture. And ECS can naturally handle object lifetimes and relationships in a way that often fits much better with Rust's borrow checker. It potentially avoids many of those ownership headaches.
So the architecture matters a lot.
Hugely. And the author also touched on the idea that maybe game engines, with their need for really flexible data access, fast iteration every frame, and sort of late binding behaviors, maybe that doesn't always perfectly align with Rust's compile time strictness. They used an analogy comparing random access in tar versus zip files.
Okay, so where did they migrate to?
They moved the engine to C#.
C#, okay. And what were the benefits they found?
They reported a pretty big reduction in the amount of code they had to write. They credited C# features like runtime reflection code, examining itself, plus expression trees and source generators. Apparently, these let them eliminate a lot of the boilerplate code often needed for things like ECS, making the code base smaller and easier to maintain.
Huh. C# as an alternative. There was even a comment suggesting it's a good step up for teams hitting limits with JavaScript or TypeScript on Node.js.
Yeah, that was an interesting perspective. The argument being C# type system and features offer a good path forward from TypeScript. It was also pointed out that many game engines use scripting languages like Lua anyway for the actual gameplay logic.
Right, where compile times aren't the bottleneck because you can hot reload scripts.
Exactly. Compile the engine once, iterate on the scripts quickly.
Now, you can't discuss Rust Online without touching on the community's enthusiasm, can you?
Hey, yeah. Someone jokingly mentioned the religious fervor that sometimes surrounds Rust. It definitely evokes strong opinions. There was also a bit of discussion on whether LLMs, AI code assistants, might affect Rust adoption if they aren't trained as well on it compared to older languages.
But the counter is that Rust's own ecosystem is pretty strong.
Right. Others argued the crates, while sometimes having breaking changes, are generally stable, and the safety guarantees save a ton of debugging time in the long run. So definitely two sides to that story.
Okay, from language wars to startup struggles. The Side Hustle from Hell. That title alone tells a story.
It really does. Yeah, this author shared their experience with an 11-month side project that went pretty badly wrong. A real cautionary tale.
What were the main issues? Let me guess. Non-technical co-founders.
Bingo. Three of them, apparently. That was flag number one. Then, relentless scope creep. The project just kept getting bigger and changing direction.
Always a danger sign.
Definitely. Then they decided to outsource the core product development overseas. The result. An app that was apparently subpar, inflexible, it even had a weird locked aspect ratio.
Oh, wow. Not good.
And the kicker, the author never actually got the equity they were promised.
Ouch. That's rough. I bet the HN comments recognized that pattern.
Immediately.
Yeah.
People called it a classic dead-end startup story, hitting all the common red flags. Though some pointed out, and the authors seem to agree, that even failing like this can be a valuable, if painful, business lesson. It apparently helped jumpstart their later career.
That outsourcing decision seemed to strike a chord, too.
Big time. Lots of warnings against outsourcing your core product, especially early on. Communication issues, quality control. It's just really hard to delegate the heart of your idea effectively. The feeling that execution is easy and can just be handed off, often a mistake.
And that dynamic between the tech person and the non-tech founders.
Yeah, that came up too. The risk of non-technical founders maybe not fully appreciating the complexity of development, seeing it as a commodity. Interestingly, an owner of an outsourcing firm commented saying, look, most clients don't understand development well, and success really requires a client to be deeply involved and informed.
Given how often these stories pop up, someone even joked about a certificate of dumb investment.
Yeah, for people who ignore all the obvious warning signs. It's a bit cynical, but reflects the high failure rate.
It's a tough world out there. The discussion also touched on careers inside big companies, surprisingly.
It did, briefly. Someone drew a parallel between startup frustration and sometimes feeling stuck or hitting promotion ceilings in larger organizations. But then, countering the negativity, someone else shared a story of their successful side hustle that grew and was eventually sold. So it's not all doom and gloom.
One thing that stood out was the lack of good contracts.
Yes. That was highlighted as a major, maybe overlooked, red flag. No clear contracts spelling out equity, responsibilities, what happens if things go wrong, that's crucial. And there was a cool suggestion about maybe using LLMs now to analyze contracts, spot potential issues.
Fascinating idea. Okay, last stop today. Digging into the guts of an old DOS game. The Games. Winter Challenge. Sounds like digital archaeology.
It really is. Someone went deep for reverse engineering this game. And it started with finding just three letters in the code. F-A-B.
F-A-B. What's that?
That immediately told the author the game was compressed using LZEXE, a really common DOS compression tool made by Fabrice Bellard.
Ah, okay. So step one, decompress the game.
Yep. But even that wasn't simple. The game didn't use the standard way of managing code overlays.
Overlays, like loading parts of the game into memory as needed.
Exactly. Because memory was so limited back then, this game had its own custom system for loading and unloading code and data, which made analyzing it harder. The author had to grapple with, 16-bit architecture, segments, offsets, the whole DOS memory management puzzle.
It sounds like peeling an onion, layer after layer.
Totally. They even figured out a clever way to check if they had extracted all the game's resources correctly by tricking the game into loading individual files instead of packed data. A big breakthrough was managing to combine all those overlays into one big file. That made tracing the logic way easier.
Did the game try to fight back? anti-debugging tricks?
Oh, absolutely. It had code to detect if a debugger was attached, and it threw in misleading instructions just to confuse anyone reading the assembly code. And interestingly, modern computers are too fast for some of the game's timing-based checks, so they had to slow down the emulator, DOSBox, to even see the copy protection work properly.
Too fast for its own good. So what was the copy protection?
It was a classic code wheel check. The game came with a physical cardboard wheel.
I remember those.
Yeah. The game would show you a random configuration on screen. You'd use the wheel to find a corresponding ticket number and type it in. The game had a routine full of confusing extra steps to verify your number against an internal table. There was even a second, slightly different version of the check in the code, maybe unused or for misdirection.
And if you got it wrong, did the game just crash?
No, much more annoying. It subtly sabotaged the gameplay depending on the event. In biathlon, your aim would be off. In downhill, gravity felt lower, so you'd fly off jumps uncontrollably.
Sneaky.
Right. Bobsled had extra drag, making good times impossible. And luge would just disqualify you instantly if you were doing too well near the end.
Wow, that's elaborate. So cracking it wasn't easy.
Apparently not. The author mentioned earlier, cracks didn't fully disable all these effects. The famous cracking group, Razer 1911, eventually succeeded by intercepting system. Interrupts, basically.
Yeah.
Catching the game's requests to the operating system and modifying them on the fly to bypass the checks entirely.
It's amazing the back and forth between developers protecting their games and crackers trying to break in.
It really is. A whole hidden layer of technical ingenuity from that era.
Well, that wraps up quite a journey through today's Hacker News front page. We went from, you know, keeping the lights on across Europe to building custom chips for Python, debating Rust versus C# for games, learning from startup failures,
and uncovering the secrets of a 90s DOS game. It's amazing how varied the tech world is.
It really is. And you see these threads, right? Compliant systems, innovation, human factors, the challenge of managing complexity, whether it's a power grid or a code base.
Absolutely. It all kind of speaks to this constant push and pull in technology, building resilience, overcoming limitations, understanding how things really work under the hood. So maybe a final thought for everyone listening, reflecting on all these different challenges we talked about today, the grid, the custom hardware, the side hustle pitfalls, the game cracking. Which of these seemingly disconnected areas actually holds the most surprising lessons for our future as technology gets even more woven into everything we do?
Definitely something to chew on. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive today. As always, check out the discussions on Hacker News yourself and feel free to share your thoughts.